Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with your host, executive editor of Newsbusters, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome on a frosty day in Washington. We're comfortably ensconced in here at the Media Research Center studio, but today is March for Life Day, downtown in D.C. It is one of those days where it's crisp enough where protesters get extra credit. I've been to a few marches for life, some of them unseasonably warm for January. This is not one of those. I think that we can guess, as we usually guess here at Newsbusters, that a March for Life protest is something that our media will try to ignore, especially under Democrat presidents. We used to, at least under Trump, have Trump either show up at the march or speak at the White House into the march. So that would get some attention because the president was actually participating. There's no president participating today. And, you know, NPR had this whole policy where they said, well, we're going to allow our reporters to participate in protests for social justice. We can guess probably no NPR reporters down there today at the March for Life, either to march or to cover it. Let's just guess. Yes, National Public Radio is a taxpayer-funded sandbox for the left, as we've just seen again this week with NPR Supreme Court reporter Nina Totenberg. She's been a hack over there since at least the 80s, I think probably the 1970s. But most notably so in trying to take down Douglas Ginsburg's nomination to the Supreme Court, she succeeded. And trying to take down Clarence Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court, where she failed. And then she became bosom buddies with Ruth Bader Ginsburg throughout her entire tenure at the Supreme Court. They would appear at events together. Palsy-walsy. And when CNN made a kiss-ass documentary, there they were at Sundance. I mean, the idea that NPR gives one whit about what the average taxpayer cares, it's obvious that they don't. Well, but in this particular case, Nina Totenberg stepped in it. She was trying to do a sassy little piece on that Neil Gorsuch went without a mask during oral arguments. Scandalous. Well, her story was that Chief Justice John Roberts had said in some form that the justices should all wear a mask to oral arguments in deference to Sonia Sotomayor, who suffers from diabetes. Then it was later discovered, guess what? Judge Roberts made a statement saying, this is false. I did not do that. And the Supreme Court put out a statement from Sotomayor and Gorsuch saying, we are friends. There's no meanness going on here. It sort of undercut everything that NPR was trying to do. And here's the thing. It's not just what NPR was trying to do. It's what everyone else did with it that becomes part of the problem. Drew Holden assembled one of his epic Twitter threads on all the progressive pickups of this fake news from NPR. We could just see it on MSNBC. They had Democrat hack Brian Fallon was on the Nicole Wallace show touting Totenberg's quote-unquote terrific reporting. Yeah, when a Democrat hack who suppresses all the Biden bad news says you're a terrific reporter, you're probably a Democrat hack. He said, what a mean-spirited, almost ghoulish person Gorsuch is. Joy Reid fussed Gorsuch could not be bothered to extend a life-saving courtesy to his coworker. You know, this is the kind of stuff. I'm so tired of COVID and all of the mask shaming one way or the other. Look at those Democrats not wearing a mask. Look at those Supreme Court justices not wearing a mask. Tired of it. Dead tired of it. And then to just try to say, this is where the conventional wisdom now has been shifting. Like, well, cloth masks don't really do anything. Surgical masks are slightly better, but now they're like, everybody needs to wear an N95, so they're classically breathing into themselves and overheating. But it's just the whole idea that you're going to shame Neil Gorsuch. He didn't wear a mask. And everybody on the court, everybody up there is triple vaxxed. And they're treating him like a super spreader. Just stop. Eddie Glaude's tweeting, these people are monsters. I mean, people don't have any idea what a monster is. If you're a monster for not wearing a mask when you're triple vaccinated, get over yourself. So, of course, what made this hilarious was the first reporter to undercut Nina Totenberg was Fox reporter Shannon Bream. Shannon Bream, who has reported on the court, she knows what she's doing on these legal matters. She had a source that said this wasn't true, that Sotomayor wasn't upset with Gorsuch. And, of course, Brian Stelter in the Reliably Liberal Reliable Sources newsletter says NBC's incredibly well-sourced Nina Totenberg published a scoop. She cited multiple sources. Shannon Bream had her own source. In essence, Bream was absolving Gorsuch. Oh, absolving Gorsuch. Like, yeah, he went out and made sure he engaged in several, committed several abortions. I mean, the idea that somehow Gorsuch is a super sinner. Get over it, Brian. Somehow it doesn't matter if Andrew Cuomo touches a bunch of women. Chris Cuomo's squeezing his boss on the ass. Jeffrey Toobin's doing what Jeffrey Toobin does. Stelter doesn't care, but Gorsuch needs to be absolved of not wearing a mask. Guess what? Stelter was wrong. CNN was wrong. NPR was wrong. And they're the ones that are out there going, CNN is hiring more people to fight misinformation on the social media. Yeah, why don't you start with yourselves, you losers? Stop spreading lies about what's going on in the Supreme Court. You know, Brianna Keeler's doing this show that nobody's watching, pompously titled Democracy in Peril. She had a segment the other night where she's saying, we can't discuss the tsunami of disinformation jeopardizing American democracy without talking about the mothership, Fox News. Yeah, this is the way they talk at CNN. And then they wonder why people are like, hey, is CNN a news channel? No, CNN is not a news channel. CNN's just an anti-Fox News channel. So what made this amusing was Nina Totenberg was so wrong that the public editor got involved, Kelly McBride, who does next to nothing over there because she's got another job at the Poynter Institute. And she wrote a piece basically trying to say, well, this requires kind of a clarification. I didn't really like some of the adjectives. I mean, talk about underdoing it. I mean, clearly she was just doing it. This is what you hate about people that are supposed to be the public editor, meaning they're bringing public complaints to the media outlet. Kelly McBride writes about it's all about defending the mothership. We think that it just needed a slight clarification. And then guess what happens? Nina Totenberg goes out and basically denounces that there's a public editor article. I'm not going to read it, she told people. It was in the Daily Beast. I'm not even going to read. When my own employer hires a person to say you suck, I'm not going to read it. What kind of journalist is that? We're not asking Nina Totenberg to read from Newsbusters. That would really upset her. It's your own ombudsman inside your network, you putz. I'm not reading it. Well, you're about as open-minded then as Trump. But this is the way it is. You know, for conservatives, we just know that this is part of Totenberg's long taxpayer-funded career of liberal propaganda. Trying to destroy conservatives, trying to puff up the Ruth Bader Ginsburgs on our money. And don't give us this garbage about NPR. It's only 2% of funding from taxpayers. No. A third of their money's federal because they do this shell game where they send all this money to the NPR stations and then the NPR stations send it back to Washington for programming. This is mostly taxpayer funded, whether it's federal funds, state funds. Sometimes it's not CPB funds. It could be National Endowment for the Humanities funds. This is state-run radio for the Democrats, and Nina Totenberg is the poster girl. Joining us now in the Newsbusters podcast, managing editor Curtis Hauken is Bengals black and orange.
Yes, I am ready for this weekend. I think they're going to pull the upset. I wouldn't view it as an upset if they do win, but that's just me.
Well, good, good. I mean, it's exciting that Bengals got their first playoff wins in, what, 30 years?
Exactly. You know, you just got to get off the schneid, and once you do, you never know what's going to happen. Just like the Capitals a few years ago, once they got past the Pittsburgh Penguins, you know, once you get the monkey off your back,
boom,
you just let it go.
So Curtis is here because he is the master of all things briefings and press conferences. So, yes, we had the second formal press conference of Biden's presidency at the beginning of year two, or at the very, very end of year one. And so Curtis has done several items for Newsbusters on this, and we're going to start by discussing how the our side of the media, the way they would see it, did. We'll start with Peter Ducey, who I think Joe Biden has to pretend to be joshing with him. Let's listen to that.
You always ask me the nicest questions. I know you do.
All right.
None of them make a lot of sense to me, but I
well, let's try.
Fire away. Come on.
A new year. Why are you trying so hard in your first year to pull the country so far to the left?
Well, I'm not.
Now, this question, Curtis, is a perfect summation of the kind of question conservatives in general would put to Biden. It puts the whole onus on the Democratic Party is far to the left. You as a president have been far to the left. And of course, he has to go and say, no, I'm a capitalist. I mean, it's like, no. Look at your actual bills. Look at what you're trying to pass. What on earth is Build Back Better? That's not a capitalist bill.
Right. And of course, he didn't get a follow up at all.
Well, he obviously wasn't obnoxious and Acosta-like enough.
Exactly. Exactly. It's actually about important issues of the day. And it elicited a response from Biden. You know, it was a tight, short question that Ducey can put on camera. But also, he can, and I think it's helpful for viewers and listeners when you were able to ask a short question and then you can hear the person's answer. So then you hear both sides, how the question is stated and how that person answers it. So there's no ambiguity whatsoever. And it was interesting because the president did talk about having vanquished Bernie Sanders in the primary. And I'm not Bernie Sanders, but Bernie Sanders is in charge of the purse strings in the Senate, in the budget committee, I believe. So it's very interesting for him to have made that case. And I would have been interested to see how Ducey would have handled that. He said with Harris Faulkner on Friday that if he would have been able to ask more questions, he would have talked about crime, which is something that a lot of people have pointed to as a topic not covered in the press conference. But I'll just close by saying that's how it goes sometimes. You get one question and then you move on. So it's not exactly a shot at Ducey for not getting in there. It's you have so many questions, and when you don't get to question this president the way that the press have been able to, you really have to figure out what are you going to do? What is your best one bullet that you're going to fire off?
Well, I think that the people watching this press conference would watch this and say, well, how many minutes were we in? 45, 50 minutes before he got to Ducey? I mean, it was well into this long press conference. And then Kristen Welker's asking like four. Mary Bruce asked three or four. So that's where you're like, well, Ducey needs at least two.
Right. I said that on OAN the other night, where like, this is the problem. A lot of these questions, the reporters like Ducey are going to use themselves asking the questions as sound bites in their reports. But then the problem becomes, in a lot of these cases, it's about things that everyone knows the answer to already.
Yeah.
And that was the issue with Mary Bruce's questions. Mary Bruce was saying, are you going to break it up? Do you think are you hopeful that, you know, you're still going to get something done? It was questions to that effect. And like, well, you're like, of course, the president's not going to be like, I hope my agenda doesn't pass. No, that's not.
Well, they treated it as newsworthy that he was going to try to break up, quote unquote, Build Back Better into chunks. You know, it's fascinating that he would say, I'm not a socialist. And in the same press conference, he was saying, you know, I've basically spent more money than any other president. You know what I mean? It's like, make up your mind there, pal.
Yeah.
But the Philip Wegman, Real Clear Politics, right?
Yeah.
Was talking about, we did have one of the more interesting parts of this press conference was asking about free and fair elections and basically the way the Democrats have been suggesting that we're not going to get them, basically, if the Democrats lose. So credit to Wegman for sticking to that and talking about civility too.
I wanted to clarify, a moment ago you were asked whether or not you believed that we would have free and fair elections in 2022 if some of these state legislatures reformed their voting protocols. You said that it depends. Do you think that they would in any way be illegitimate?
Oh, yeah, I think it easily can be illegitimate.
In regards to 2022, sir, the midterm
2022,
election.
I mean, imagine if those attempts to say that the count was not legit. You have to recount it, or we're not going to count, we're going to discard the following votes. I mean, sure, I'm not saying it's going to be legit.
You campaigned and you ran on a return to civility. And I know that you dispute the characterization that you called folks who would oppose those voting bills as being Bull Connor or George Wallace. But you said that they would be sort of in the same camp.
No, I didn't say that. Look what I said. Go back and read what I said. And tell me if you think I called anyone who voted on the side of the position taken by Bull Connor, that they were Bull Connor.
And
that is an interesting reading of English. I assume you got into journalism because you like to write.
So did you expect that would work with Senators Manchin or Sinema?
No, here's argument. The thing. There's certain things that are so consequential.
So in that first one, when he talked about whether there will be free and fair elections, this was a follow-up when he said a moment ago. That refers back to the fifth question of the press conference from Allison Harris of News Nation, a channel I really like, even though they don't really quite have the viewership. She had asked about voting rights legislation. If this isn't passed, you still believe the upcoming election will be fairly conducted and its results will be legitimate. And Biden said it all depends on whether or not we're able to make the case to the American people that some of this is being set up to try to alter the outcome of the election. So Wegman followed up with that. And it was funny. Biden started giving an answer, and then he started talking about 2020 as if we're in the year 2020. And then Wegman had to jump in and basically be like, sir, this is 2022. And then the other question was asking about the Georgia speech that he gave. And he even granted him the point that you dispute the characterization that you called folks who oppose these voting rights bills as being Bull Connor and George Wallace, but you said they would be in the same camp. That was the argument that Jen Psaki made, even though she said that this was a nonpartisan speech. This is what Don Lemon and all the rest have been saying. But then Biden, showing he's clearly not in charge of his faculties or even realizing what he actually said or didn't remember what John Meacham wrote for him, started lashing out and saying, no, I didn't say that.
Well, it's fascinating to me that Joe Biden or any of Joe Biden's defenders would try to say, I didn't say you were Bull Connor and George Wallace or Jefferson Davis. I said you were on the side of Bull Connor and George Wallace. And it's like, how is that any difference? If I said to Joe Biden, I'm not saying you're on the side of Fidel Castro, or I'm not saying you're Fidel Castro, you're on the side of Fidel Castro, you're on the side of Hugo Chavez. I mean, the guy can't even be on the side of Bernie Sanders. He's trying to deny he's on the side of Bernie Sanders.
Right. I forget who it was. I don't know if it was Jen Psaki or another one of Biden's flacks or defenders made a case a day or two after the speech that, you know, we're not, you know, when we're saying you aren't that person, you know, of course we're not saying civil rights leaders today are Martin Luther King Jr. because they're not Martin Luther King Jr. Yes, we understand basic biology and cloning and all that stuff, idiots. We're talking about whether you are that person, a reincarnation, I guess, the epitome of that person, when you're saying, no, we're just in the same camp. But Biden can't even accept that because he doesn't know what he's talking about. But the uproar from Biden there is the kind of thing that CNN would spend multiple segments on multiple days talking about, harassment of the free press. Yamiche Alcindor afterward praised Biden for having not shouted at reporters, which in that exchange proves to be totally false. But to Wegman's credit, he hung in there and then said, so did you expect that to work with Senator's Manchin or Sinema?
Right.
Which is a funny, amusing question, obviously.
Yeah, but it's a rhetorical question.
But it's a real question, yeah, too. And he said, no, here's the thing. There are certain things that are so consequential. You have to speak from your heart.
Yeah. Please. Oh, okay. There are some things that are so consequential, we have to self-destruct.
Right. Oh, no.
I like the idea that people did. He was getting questions in the press conference about, you campaigned on unity, sir, which he did, and normalcy, and so on. Well, you're not running a normal presidency when you're saying anyone who opposes me is on the side of horrible segregationists. That is not civil. It is not accurate. As much as our fact checkers can't handle it, PolitiFact did a piece going, let's put this in context. Yeah, let's put this in context. You're pathetic, PolitiFact. That's the context. You can't even treat this as a fact check. You know, they freak out. There was a thing just a couple of weeks ago in Tampa. They put up a billboard suggesting that Kathy Castor was a communist. And it was like, pants on fire. They have a fit. And it's like, well, how come you can always have a fit on behalf of the Democrats? But, you know, you can call Republicans segregationists and... Well, you guys need to put it in context. You were talking about Biden's mental faculties, which means we have to go to the James Rosen question.
I'd like to raise a delicate subject, but with utmost respect for your life accomplishments and the high office you hold. A poll released this morning by Politico Morning Consult found 49% of registered voters disagreeing with the statement, Joe Biden is mentally fit. Well, not even a majority of Democrats who responded strongly affirmed that statement.
Well, I'll let you all make the judgment whether they're correct.
The question I have for you, sir, if you'd let me finish, is why do you suppose such large segments of the American electorate have come to harbor such profound concerns about your cognitive fitness? Thank you.
I have no idea.
Now, I ask you, Curtis, was Biden's answer the right answer? Because I think you could make an argument that the shorter the answer, the better.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, but what's funny about this is, this to me is the Brian Stelter question. You know, Brian Stelter's like, far right people question Biden's mental fitness. Well, what on earth were you?
You had actual psychologist Bandy Lee.
Yeah.
Like, for goodness sake.
Yeah, you had entire segments on how he's mentally feeble, and then you put on a mentally feeble guy to say he's going to kill more people than Hitler, Stalin, and Mao.
Yeah, and then you claim that you didn't hear it. I was playing
with the baby during that answer.
Yes. Yes. Biden's answers were just great. And I thought Rosen's follow-up was correct. Why do such large segments of American electorate have come to harbor such profound concerns?
Yeah.
No idea.
Well, I think it is a challenging question. It could be seen as a rude question, but it was stated politely, as the way James Rosen typically does these things. And then we had Stephen Nelson of the New York Post. I appreciate this question about, when you discuss things with Xi Jinping, where do we get into the COVID origins?
Right. I think, and I point this out in my story at Newsbusters, that Nelson has made China, Hunter Biden, transparency issues in general, his credo core, his calling card in the briefing room. And it's made Psaki upset because it's so off the beaten path from other reporters. But you and I have talked about this before, and you know this personally, that coming into a briefing room, you know, and I think not only does it help the press secretary, it helps everybody by asking questions that aren't the same question stated for a fifth different time.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you were suggesting before. It's like Mary Bruce is coming in and sort of re-chewing the convention of wisdom. And, you know, let's have something that actually moves the ball. So you did a second article on sort of the best and worst reporters in what we might call the legacy media, the old media. We certainly don't call it the mainstream media unless we want Brent Bozell to look at us sternly.
Yeah,
he does not like the phrase mainstream media. But you mentioned Allison Harris of News Nation, which if you should check for that on your cable or satellite provider.
WGN, you know, think of what was the channel that growing up you used to be able to watch Chicago sports games?
Oh, with Harry Carey?
Yes, be able to watch that has turned into News Nation.
So this is a network that is trying to do the news straight and down the middle. Which ain't easy. But also, Jennifer Epstein of Bloomberg, I think, was really the one who really made the most news, because she basically was suggesting, what are you doing on Russia and Ukraine? And got this bizarre answer about where Biden basically suggested, well, you could probably do a minor incursion and nothing will happen. I mean, her question was basically suggesting that the U.S. and the European allies can't quite come together on how to handle Russian troops massing on Ukraine's border. I mean, it was a good substantive question with sort of a bumbling answer.
Right. I'll just read it here. If U.S. and NATO allies aren't willing to put troops on the line, can't agree on a sanctions package, hasn't the U.S. and the West lost nearly all of its leverage over Vladimir Putin? And given how ineffective sanctions have been in deterring Putin in the past, why should the threat of new sanctions give him pause?
Yeah.
Perfectly normal question.
Yeah.
Jennifer Epstein sometimes is really, I think I'm blocked by her. She occasionally says stupid things, but this time she came through. And yeah, this was not a gotcha. This is not really a gotcha question. And again, this is an example of good question.
Well,
asking of questions, because you're saying this is it's provable that the sanctions last time under the same regime did not affect Putin's behavior. Why do you expect the result to be different?
Yeah, I mean, I think if she was putting it with more anti-Biden spin, you could certainly say sanctions and all of that certainly didn't stop him from taking Crimea under Obama Biden. She didn't do that.
No.
And I would have enjoyed that, but that's, you know, right. This is the context that's missing when these people, all the mainstream, quote unquote, people get up there and say, you know, Biden's telling Russia, you better not mess around. And you're like, yeah, Obama tried that too. And then, of course, the obvious context missing is these people spent years saying that Trump was in Russia's pocket. Well, this never happened under Trump.
Yeah,
it happened under Obama. Now it's threatening to happen under Biden. Couldn't we deduce that maybe Trump was put more fear in Putin's heart than Obama and Biden have?
You and I talked about this in the newsroom yesterday. The point being that if Trump was in Putin's pocket and was a secret agent for Putin, why didn't he invade Ukraine and really any and all former Soviet like satellite nations? Honestly, ask yourself that question. Why didn't he do it? So this notion that I believe it was Aaron Burnett's show had a segment a few nights ago suggesting that Putin's in this position is because Trump made America so weak and that now Biden has to deal with it. It just doesn't. Yeah. It just does not add up based on the funding that we gave them, the lethal weapons we've given them, the anti-tank missiles interceptions that we've given them, and Poland, another country that Putin and Russia aren't necessarily fans of right now. They're screwing with them with Belarus by sending migrants across the border to distract them. You know, the results and the facts simply don't add up. And again, this is an example of how in our news culture, and this is more broadly an issue about the press that we have right now, which is nuance and subtleties or more germane points, such as how much has not Trump himself, but the administration writ large, and what Mike Pompeo would say at the State Department has meant in terms of U.S. policy versus what Trump tweeted about. And the press in many cases will go to the shiny object of whatever Trump has tweeted or not tweeted or said, instead of actually look at what an administration's record is.
Well, now we can try to play journalism professor for a minute and say the news media was always going to go for the Trump shiny object because they wanted to portray him as a moron and a bull in a china shop and all that. But you could also argue that they're doing that because it's just more, it's easier to talk about. It's not so complicated. It's not like we're all going to discuss, we're all going to sit down and have a geopolitical conversation. You know, they would say, oh, that's going to bore people. They don't want you to talk about Belarus. They couldn't find Belarus on a map. Right. You know what I mean? And so they wanted to talk about it on, you know, Trump's level, which means, yeah, you're right. They got to completely avoid the nuance of how Trump's actual policies were tougher on Putin than Obama's were, because Trump's public rhetoric was at times very pro-Putin.
Pro-Putin. Helsinki, anybody?
Right.
I mean, but yeah, again, this goes to the issue of they're not willing to look at it and or point out the fact that, yeah, who was in charge when Russia previously invaded? You've pointed this out as well. Why won't they point out that the same people are now in charge of when that happened? Tony Blinken and Wendy Sherman were both at the State Department. And you honestly think Sergey Lavrov and Vladimir Putin are shaking in their boots? Even Stephen Colbert last night was talking about making fun of Biden's claim that, like, Putin will regret it if he invades. Like, clearly pointing out that, like, Putin is even admitting that Putin is not scared of Joe Biden. When Stephen Colbert is saying that, that's not good.
Well, I think that suddenly it reminds me of Trump basically going abroad at a press conference and saying that Obama lost Crimea. And guess who got up and yelled at him? Yamiche Alcindor. She got very upset that he suggested Obama was a dummy. How dare you suggest Obama did anything that made him look less than intelligent?
Well, I have to, Yamiche, I mean, that was Kristen Welker. Speaking of Kristen Welker from earlier, it felt like her question to Biden about black voters was like fed to her by Yamiche, because Yamiche is now with NBC News, folks. So fortunately, depending on your pain factor, whenever you tune into Soundbites of the Saki Show, she will not, it appears, not be at the briefings anymore. So you have to feed those kinds of sorts of questions to somebody else now.
Well, and you put Welker on your list of the worst questions. And I think that there's no doubt that listening to Kristen Welker trying to make this case for the Al Sharpton lobby that Biden's worthless and weak and not doing enough on voting rights, you could at least argue, I suppose, that it wasn't a softball to Biden. It wasn't a question he liked. However, we've all been pointing and laughing at the president of NBC News, Noah Oppenheim, doing an interview with this liberal Tom Jones guy. Tom Jones. Not that Tom Jones. Nobody throws panties at this Tom Jones. Doing an interview where the president of NBC News said, we're ferociously committed to objectivity and nonpartisanship. Obviously, Kristen Welker didn't get that memo in her question to Biden.
No. I mean, granted, she did ask about, is the country more unified than when you first took office?
Yep.
And she, what do you say to those offended by his speech? She actually twice asked whether the country is more united or not. And she did try to clean up by pointing out that, are you satisfied with Kamala Harris's work on voting rights? And can you commit that she'll be your running mate in 2024, provided you run again? And Biden said yes and yes, which, to Biden's credit, is actually the clearest that both he or his vice president have been, I don't know, in weeks or months, I guess. So that, but, and that's sort of a moving the ball down the field sort of question that was fine. And you definitely want to get answers to, because otherwise, as I've said before, a lot of these questions were kind of unimaginative, pedantic, pick your word.
Well, I think that you're at the year point, and, you know, how's Kamala doing? If you're judging that by how the Voting Rights Bill is passed and how the border is under control, doesn't look so good. But Biden is president. Jeff Dickens has a piece up in Newsbusters about all of the laughable gaffes and disasters in the communications shop of Vice President Harris. You'll want to take a look at that. There's some funny videos. And but I think it's obvious that they all do want to sort of ask this question, are you keeping her? But I think the Kristen Welkers of the world are sort of coming at that from the perspective of, you better keep her.
Right, yeah. Because dumping him for Mayor Pete, as much as the D.C. area rich white liberals love Pete Buttigieg, I don't think they would be very happy if that happened. I think Joy Reid would have an aneurysm.
As long as it's on air.
Yeah, I gotta see it. I gotta see it.
Well, I mean, maybe that's not very nice, but the reality is, you know, she's not very nice. I mean, there's not any time that goes by. You know, we were starting the show by talking about Neil Gorsuch, and, you know, Joy has to start with, Republicans love the COVID, huh?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is very sadistic and terrible. She talked last year about how Ron DeSantis is not concerned about keeping Floridians alive.
Yeah.
I mean,
she's from Florida, isn't she? She certainly worked for Obama down
there. She lived in Florida. She's from Colorado. So she's been from a number of different spots, but she often talks about, yes, Colorado and Florida is her two, I guess, formative places that she's lived.
So, you also talked about this guy named Alex Nazarian of Yahoo News. He used to be with Newsweek, or the what I like to refer to as the shell formerly known as Newsweek. I mean, it's not what it used to be. I guess you could argue Time Magazine's not what it used to be.
And neither
either.
Is Yahoo News. Yahoo News still exists.
They're sending this joker into the White House.
Oh.
You dinged him twice.
I did. You know, the first one, I said it was the worst question in the briefing. You said you were surprised by Republican obstruction of your agenda, but didn't the GOP take exactly the same tactic when you were vice president to Barack Obama? So why did you think they would treat you any differently than they treated him? And then the second question we can talk is, I put it at number 3 out of 5 on my list, is there's increasing concern, I think, among some Democrats that even if schools do continue to open, Republicans will weaponize this narrative of you and other leading Democrats of allowing them to stay closed. So,
I grasp on the words weaponizing the narrative. I mean, I'm frankly just personally, I tend to dislike the term weaponizing. But if anybody's weaponizing the narrative, it's the news media.
Right. And I think this goes to an overarching point that we've talked about, kind of hinted at a couple of times in this segment, which is the media are continuing with their idea of woe is Joe. And this is a standard thing for Democrats, liberals in general, when bad things happen. It's kind of woe is them. Why aren't voters listening? It's the Paul Begala argument. People are stupid.
They have bad. We don't have bad leaders. We have bad followers.
We have bad followers. Woe is Joe. He's overcome so much in his life, and the Republicans now just will not give him wins here at the end of his life, which is, it's so absurd. Like, we're supposed to feel sorry for Joe Biden, that he just trusted Republicans too much, that he cared too much.
I don't think that we've seen a lot of moving toward the middle in any way. I think that that's, you know, you cited Zeke Miller, and Zeke Miller was basically asking, did you overreach? Which on some level you could suggest. That's a very cliched question, and we've certainly heard it before. But you and I disagree just a little bit on that, because I think it's quite clear they overreached. I think it's quite clear that these people...
Overpromised.
Yeah. It's quite clear that when you have a 50-50 Senate, you don't get to ram massive spending bills through, and you don't get to repeal, you know, you don't get to nationalize election rules to favor the Democrats if you've got two Democrats who say, you know, we kind of like the filibuster.
Right. I kind of made the argument is that it was kind of a cushy landing. you know, and I link back to he led off because he's the AP reporter.
Right.
The first Biden press conference in March 2021, and he did a similar thing. He listed all of these challenges, and then he said, how far are you willing to go to achieve those promises that you made to the American people? Obviously, that one is way worse.
Yeah.
However, it's this 10,000, 50,000 foot view that he's taking that is just sometimes pretty gag-worthy.
Yeah, I suppose, I guess when I heard it as it began, I thought, well, that's sort of a classic first question, not just what you would expect that AP used to ask under Reagan or Bush or Obama. It's also sort of when journalists grant interviews to newsmakers, to powerful people, they usually start with something that's a little bit softer and generic just to get it, just to kick the ball a little bit. Instead of being like, yeah, can you imagine the press conference beginning with your mental fitness? Go.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I think overall, this is what I also said on my way last night, that like this had to have been one of the worst days of Jen Psaki's life, I guess. And really for any president, I would think, you know, when they start going on and on and on and they picks up their notes and they start to walk away, but then they come back and stay for another.
Well, there's so much grist here. There was so much grist here for the conservative media to hook into. But you always have to start from the idea of, well, then how is this mediated? Because most Americans weren't watching this live, like nerds like us. So how was it covered? Which clips did they use? And you can say, again, the major story was Biden kind of bumbling about the minor incursion actually became the big story on the networks and in the newspapers. So, I mean, look, at least you could say news was made. Give the press some credit because news was made, which is what's supposed to happen.
Even if they didn't really set up the questions that way,
yeah,
Biden just kind of ended up walking into making news.
Yeah, I think we can conclude that this performance underlines why they haven't had many of these.
Right, exactly.
And but probably won't have many more of them this year.
Exactly, where he's even unfamiliar, like with the Wegman exchange, with what he actually said previously, where they have to go out there and they're saying, and in the minor incursion, especially the minor incursion answer, which is, you read what he said to Jennifer Epstein, and there's zero ambiguity about what he said. And yet you have Ron Klain, Jen Psaki, et cetera, Kamala Harris out there saying, no.
All right, this is the final thought, which is the lamest. I mean, lame that you can't even get crutches and walk with this. And it happened on Twitter, and I think Chuck Todd pulled this out. It was like, a gaffe is when you're so honest and truthful. And it's like, no. When somebody bumbles this badly, don't try to turn it into a truth-telling moment, okay?
No.
Nobody's buying that, all right? So if you want to keep up on what's going on at the press conferences and the briefings, you have to follow Curtis Houck, H-O-U-C-K, all right? Follow the rest of the Newsbusters team on Twitter. And come to Newsbusters once, twice, 24 times a day. Thanks.